and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this Martin Luther King Day, we will examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's White House appearance shortly after he made vulgar and hateful remarks about Haiti, El Salvador, and the entire continent of Africa, at which he praised Dr. King, but was overshadowed by questions from the press, causing Trump to hurry out of the room, ignoring shouts of, "Are you a racist?" Kristen Clark, the president and executive director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, which leads the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition, joins us to discuss her overview of where race relations and voter enfranchisement stands in the Trump Sessions era. With a racist in the Oval Office and a relic of the Old South as the nation's top lawman supposed to protect voting rights, which Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III has always opposed, we will examine ways to turn back the turning back of the clock on civil and voting rights in the country. Then we will speak with the theologian and scholar Aubrey Hendricks, the author of The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. He joins us to discuss the moral sickness that Trump is spreading across the land with enablers like the moral midgets, Republican Senators Cotton and Perdue, joining in the Trump lies of denial when the whole world knows that the racist and hateful remarks attributed to Trump are what he said. We will discuss harnessing the power of love against the tide of hate and a revival of the religious left in the country while the religious right loses any claim of Christian legitimacy as they cling to a racist misogynist in the White House. Then finally, we will discuss the likelihood of a backlash to the Trump Sessions' assault on civil rights and voting rights in the spirit of Martin Luther King's teachings and sacrifice as the millennial generation shows signs of growing political activism in reaction to Trump and Betsy DeVos's indenturing them with student debt while Sessions tries to reverse the legalization of marijuana. Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and of African and African American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis, joins us on this Martin Luther King Day. And joining us now on this Martin Luther King Day is Kristen Clark, who is the president and executive director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, one of the country's most important national civil rights organizations, which leads the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition, made up of more than 100 local, state, and national partners working to defend the right to vote. She formerly served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau for New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, then spent several years at the NAACP, Legal Defense and Education Fund, and then also worked at the United States Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section of the division, and she has written numerous articles and books, including Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kristen Clark.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Kristen, on this Martin Luther King Day. And it's somewhat overshadowed and clouded by the recent racist remarks that Donald Trump made in the White House, referring to both Haiti, El Salvador, and the entire continent of Africa. Shortly thereafter, Donald Trump appeared at an event in the White House honoring Martin Luther King Day. He was asked directly by a African-American reporter, as it happened, one of the few black journalists in the White House press corps, April Ryan. She shouted out as the president scurried out of the room, "Mr. President, are you a racist?" Frankly, it's shocking in itself, to my mind, Kristen, that anybody would have to ask that such a question.
I couldn't agree more. You know, when I reflect on the last two Martin Luther King Day holidays in our country, I am troubled by the fact that controversy loomed over MLK Day in 2017. Last year, the president had made insulting remarks regarding one of our nation's most cherished civil rights icons, John Lewis. And this year, we go into the MLK Day holiday again with a dark cloud looming by the president's most recent remarks about people from African and Caribbean countries. I think that Martin Luther King would be saddened, disappointed, and disheartened by the fact that we have made great progress since his passing, but in such a short period of time, we've seen how fragile that progress is, and we've seen the clock turn back, and in no small part because of a president who exhibits tremendous hostility when it comes to race and civil rights in our country. We're truly at a crossroads as we move into this year's celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King. We have a lot of work to do to safeguard his legacy. He is somebody who committed his life to fighting to overcome the racial bias and hatred and animus that sadly we see today coming out of the White House and from this administration. So this is a holiday where we've really got to take a step back and recommit ourselves to doing the important work that needs to be done to safeguard his legacy and all that he fought for.
Well, in this rather perfunctory ceremony where Donald Trump read from a script, what he read was, "Today we celebrate Dr. King for standing up for the self-evident truth Americans hold so dear, that no matter what the color of our skin or the place of our birth, we are all created equal by God." Now, I must say I find that very ironic where he refers to the place of our birth. This was the man who basically propelled this birther conspiracy that President Obama was somehow born in Kenya and is a secret anti-colonial, white-hating interloper without a proper birth certificate. And then when you look at the record, culminating with the comments in the Oval Office about Africa and Haiti and El Salvador, it's pretty hard not to accept the extreme likelihood that our president is a racist. I mean, how I know he's being defended by a couple of the senators that were in there, but the other senators, everybody believes them. They believe Lindsey Graham. They believe Dick Durbin. They believe Jeff Flake. They don't believe Cotton. They don't believe Sonny Perdue. I mean, this is a pretty shocking place that we've got kind of moral midgets covering up the lies of the president, who is clearly, to many, spreading a kind of moral sickness across the land.
Yeah, and, you know, as you recite the president's words, they ring hollow. We've seen the real Donald Trump over the course of the first year of his presidency, and he's somebody who has been consistent in expressing views of hatred and animus when it comes to African Americans, when it comes to Muslims, when it comes to the LGBT community. This is somebody who really, in his first year, you know, he has embraced white supremacists and held some of them up as good people. He really has done tremendous damage to our country that will take years to unravel. I worry deeply about children and how they are internalizing a lot of the statements that they have seen from President Trump during this first year of his presidency. I worry about people who may, young people in particular, who may feel dehumanized and marginalized from a president that would use language as we've seen. I worry about those who may internalize hatred towards their neighbors of color. Just in every respect imaginable, this president has shocked the conscience and done tremendous damage to our country, truly driving a wedge in our nation. And frankly, we're seeing that impact now across the globe. So we have a lot of work to do, but the Martin Luther King Day holiday is not something that we should lose sight from. This is a man who worked feverishly throughout his life to fight back against racial injustice, to make us a more whole nation. He was someone who was a true leader. And at a moment where we are lacking leadership, strong leadership, we should be reminded of Dr. King's example and the America that he was working towards.
And again, I'm speaking with Kristen Clark, who's the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, one of the country's most important national civil rights organizations, which leads the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition. And she is the author of a number of books and articles, including Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. I must say, when you think about Barack Obama, I remember seeing this front page picture on the, I think it was on most of the newspapers, and the New York Times in particular, where Barack Obama was greeting a group of Muslims, mostly young kids, and the looks on their faces looking up at this man with absolute adoration and empowerment. I mean, you could sense that he was empowering these young kids to believe that they were as good as anybody else, and that the stigmas being thrown at them don't matter. And here you have the leader of the country reassuring a bunch of people that are being marginalized and attacked, particularly now by Donald Trump and his administration. It couldn't be a greater contrast. When you think about what's inscribed on the monuments there in Washington, D.C., of the Martin Luther King Memorial, that hate cannot conquer hate, only love can do that. Do you think that we can somehow revive the spirit of love that Martin Luther King talked about? And it wasn't a kind of weak kind of love in the sense that that love is a weak emotion compared to hate. It was an empowering version of love that he was offering.
That's right. And, you know, I'm encouraged by some of the work and movement building that we've seen across our country over the past year. It's been a difficult year for sure, but we are seeing people rising up, multiracial, multi-faith, multi-generational coalitions of people who are fighting against injustice at every turn, fighting against racial injustice, fighting against gender discrimination and harassment, fighting against Islamophobia and hate crimes in general. And when you think about it, this is what was happening during Martin Luther King's day. You had people, whites and people from all faiths, who were descending on the South to link hand in hand with Dr. King to push for integration and to fight segregation and calling for justice. So I'm really encouraged by the fact that we have an America that has been awakened, an America whose conscience has been reignited. And despite some of the darkness that we see coming out of a White House that feels so morally bankrupt, we are seeing in streets across our country people who are paying attention, people who are turning out and participating in elections, people who are marching with positive messages, reaffirming messages, as we saw during Charlottesville. Hate was not the message that was allowed to prevail that day. It was a message of love. So I'm encouraged by some of what is happening when we look beyond the White House and think that moments like this call for us to find clarity. And there's a lot of noise, I think, that surrounds reporting around the White House and President Trump. But we need to really open our eyes and pay attention to people across our country of different racial backgrounds and different faiths, who really are working together to move our country toward justice and who are fighting for the principles that underlined so much of Dr. King's work.
Well, it's often suggested that in politics, Newton's law applies, that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, and there may well be a growing backlash and even a massive electoral shift in this at the end of the year in November of 2018, the elections. Already a number of Republicans are, particularly senior chairman, abandoning ship. This is a critical week, of course, over DACA, and there's a real possibility that the government could be shut down on Friday. But when I mentioned earlier about Tom Cotton and Sonny Perdue defending Trump in a lie, when Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin and Jeff Flake and others who have basically said this is what really happened, and the whole world accepts that version. Nobody accepts Trump's version of it. So we're really into a point of real division between the lies and the truth. And frankly, you know, you've got 35% of the country living in the Fox News bubble. So it already exists in the broader sense. Do you ever foresee what will heal this nation, the divide that largely Trump has exacerbated, particularly in terms of starting from the basic principle that we have to have a consensus about what is true and what is real, particularly if you're the lone superpower, if you will, although China is on the rise. And of course, Trump's remarks insulting Africa only benefit the Chinese. What's your sense about whether or not we can start forming some kind of consensus on the basic truths?
Well, far more important than the words of the man are his actions. And when we look at President Trump's first year in office, we have seen a pattern that has been consistent. We have seen him not only articulate and express views that show and exhibit hostility and animus towards people of color and minority communities, but we've seen him push forth policies that reflect that animus. The Muslim ban, reigniting the war on drugs, attempting to stop DACA, and attempting to take action that would result in hundreds of thousands of young people who've never known another country being deported. Appointing nominees to federal court vacancies and advancing a list of nominees that is virtually all white and all male. 90% of President Trump's nominees for federal court vacancies have been white, 81% of them white male. So for those who remain confused, for those who feel like this issue is up for debate, you need not look any further than his actual actions taken during his first year in office that show that his animus towards minority and marginalized communities runs deep. We have seen a pattern from this president, a pattern of really turning the clock back when it comes to civil rights and when it comes to protecting the rights of vulnerable communities. So for those who would continue to defend the president when it comes to the question of whether or not he's racist, I urge them to look no further than the policy actions that he took during year one.
Well, Kristen Clark, I thank you very much for joining us here today on this Martin Luther King Day.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kristen Clark, who's the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, one of the country's most important national civil rights organizations, which leads the National Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition. She has served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau for New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, then spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, and also worked at the United States Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section. And she has written numerous articles and books, including Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. We're going to take a brief station break and back with a discussion of the moral sickness that Trump is spreading across the land.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this Martin Luther King Day is Aubrey Hendricks, a Senior Fellow for Faith and Opportunity at the Opportunity Agenda, a visiting scholar in Religion and African American Studies at Columbia University and Professor of Biblical Interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He's also been called one of the greatest intellectuals and most exciting scholars in America today, and is the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Aubrey Hendricks.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you for joining us. And in his final sermon on the evening of April the 3rd, 1968, with a thunderstorm outside the church, Martin Luther King made that extraordinary sermon in which he said, "The nation is sick, trouble is in the land, confusion all around." It sure feels like that now. I mean, I sense a great divide and a looming divide in this country. If, for example, the inquiry into Donald Trump's connections with the Russians is not totally unequivocal and with absolutely unassailable facts, efforts to impeach him may well open up wounds and divisions in this country. And Donald Trump's 35% or 30% of followers that live in the Fox News bubble have no idea about what's really going on, and many of them have lots of guns. So I just have a feeling, as a society, Trump is tearing us apart and taking us towards what could be a rather bloody civil strife, unless somehow we rediscover Dr. King. But I suspect we're heading in the direction that he warned us about in that sermon on April the 3rd of 1968.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's lay the blame where it is. I mean, America's been sick, and we've had these divisions from the beginning, but this current bout of sickness, one might call a relapse into the sickness of hatred, division, and racism and classism, has been engendered, exacerbated by Donald J. Trump, a hateful man, totally self-absorbed, never done anything to help anyone but himself, who's willing to sacrifice this whole nation, actually, all of its welfare, its peace, in order to make himself look and feel good. It's a sick time, and I might tell you, I don't subscribe to the to this 19th century notion of a rapture and Antichrist, which is really a misunderstanding of what Paul was talking about. But if one does believe in an Antichrist, someone who stands against everything Christ stood for, and spews that kind of hatred throughout the world, then if one is one of those believers in the Antichrist, then Donald Trump really does fulfill those criteria. He is that evil and that destructive, in my estimation, and I think it goes beyond my estimation. I think it's obvious to any real clear-eyed observer.
Well, and of course, you know, the rapture and the end of times theology, the misinterpretation of the book of Revelation, I think in many ways could be described as spiritual pornography, because it's predicated upon the idea that, you know, my life and my friends' lives have to end in burning flesh in order for a bunch of followers of these southern preachers in megachurches for them to be raptured up. So I can understand your reticence to go there. But I think you're absolutely right. This guy could qualify as the Antichrist. So when is the real second coming happen? Because the Antichrist supposedly comes before the second coming, without giving too much credit to that nonsense.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have raised that metaphor, but I was only raising because these evangelicals, they subscribe to all this stuff, and they've been using biblical prophecies to say that, prophecies from, like, the Book of Daniel to say it foretold the rise of Donald Trump and all that. And I'm saying if they really want to believe all that stuff, well, then, you know, he fulfills that also. But let's move on. That's all.
Right. Well, let's move on to the Beatitudes and the very part of the Bible that the evangelicals never talk about. And I think that's that is the legacy and the spirit of Martin Luther King, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And there are a couple of things. First, of course, Martin Luther King, I think when you read through his works, listen to his speeches and all of that, see, there are four basic ethics, I think, that he lived by. One was, in fact, the day that he said that, the day he had his kitchen table experience when he was frightened and ready to quit the Montgomery bus boycott because of death threats, he said, he heard a voice that said, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness, stand up for justice, stand up for truth. And those, I think, have been the operative ethics. Add to that love, those have been the operative ethics of his life. Now, in terms of righteousness, doing right, well, Donald Trump does not do that. I mean, he's not concerned about doing right at all. That's never been a criteria for him. The only thing that's right is what serves him. Justice, well, we don't even have to get into justice. That's more, it's more about just us these days. Truth, well, we have the biggest lie on the world stage in the White House. And then in terms of love, speaking specifically of the Beatitudes, we have just hate spewed and division spewed every day. And Martin Luther King would be horrified, of course, on those accounts, number one, but on a couple other things. First, the implications for policy. I mean, to call places S-holes, and which, you know, characterizes the people as people. You know, that kind of hatred has extraordinary implications for policies. I mean, one doesn't want to pass and support policies that help people like that, people that you think are lesser around the world. And but more than that, Martin Luther King also talked about, as you know, that in America we need, how do you put it, we need a total transformation of the architecture of society. He was about structural change, structural, social, and political change, and so that our nation would be more just, we'd have less income inequality, less corruption, less police terrorism and mistreatment of women and minorities and on down the line. And so I guess what I'm saying, Brother Ian, is that this, and I hate to harp on this presidency, but we have to. This presidency stands as the antithesis of not only everything that Martin Luther King stood for, but in my estimation, really antithesis of everything holy and righteous and just.
So let's turn to the other issue that Martin Luther King was all about, which was voting rights and getting people to vote. And he understood that was the way to political power and to representation. In many ways, going back to Trump, he, as did Bernie Sanders, really spoke to a lot of angry, upset people in this country. And I suspect in Trump's case, a lot of the angry white working class people that voted for him, maybe they hadn't voted before. So what's going to get people out to vote on the political left, if that's a way to describe it, given that those folks that voted for Trump have been absolutely conned? He ran as a populist, but he's governing as a plutocrat. I don't know whether they're going to figure out they've been had, but what about, again, going back to the 65% majority as opposed to the 35% who support Trump? Do you see that notion of Newton's law applying to our politics? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you're right. I think what Donald Trump has done is not only mobilize his base, but I think ultimately, to his chagrin, he's mobilized a base that's going to stand against his depredations. People of goodwill, there are a lot of people of goodwill who are fooled by Donald Trump, but people of goodwill who see through Donald Trump are really, really, I think, quite mobilized and quite energized now. And we're seeing a lot more candidates willing to stand tall in districts and areas and regions where they didn't feel that Democrats had any chance in the past. Well, they're feeling empowered now. Outraged and empowered because of Donald Trump. He's outraged folks, but he's also wounded his party. And I think we saw that very clearly in Alabama. I mean, how could a Democrat have ever won in Alabama just a few years ago? Well, you know, Trump, and it's, look at Virginia. Look everywhere you look. New Jersey, Trump is being rejected. In terms of voting rights, I think that we have such a very hard fight because there has to be more attention put on these very real efforts to stand in the way of voting rights, to strip people of voting rights, turning the clock back. Speaking of Martin Luther King, it's horrible. It's like, it's almost like we've made, we're on our way back to 50 years ago, 60 years ago. And, I mean, that's got to be really frightening. I don't know how, if the American populace is really clear on how greatly a conservative effort this is in America by the right wing to shut down voting rights in every kind of way. It's absolutely frightening. And so what we see is that we see a party that's not looking to serve the American people, but to rule the American people and to be able to get away with whatever it wants to get away with in service to those to whom they have the most fealty, who turn out to be the plutocrats.
So I don't know that there's any accurate statistics on, first of all, on the Trump base and how big it is. They keep saying 30 to 35%. These numbers keep going down. But I would like to find out exactly how many people in this country hold kind of racist views similar to Trump's, because we simply don't know. And as we pointed out, politics is often about who is mobilized to come out to vote. And we're talking about the possibility of a backlash of people now being mobilized in opposition to Trump. But the one area where there's some hope, I think, and evidence of a complete change in consciousness and outlook, and that is the millennial generation. So what's your reading on that? Do you think that if there's a way to get the young people out, then maybe they can help turn the tables?
Yeah, I believe so. You know, I teach at Columbia University, and I have and most of my students are undergraduates. And what's so amazing to them is that some of this, the horrors of racism and the racial tensions are so alien to so many of these young people. I'm talking about the white young people. It's just something they can't fathom. I think that we're seeing some serious demographic changes. We're seeing a great deal of growth in consciousness on the one hand. The other hand, I think there's an open, it's interesting to look at this openness, these statistics that show the openness to socialism on the part of millennials. And of course, we're not talking about communism or totalitarianism, but you know, we're talking about a society that is more concerned about the social good, the common good, than just the enrichment of individuals. I think this augurs well for where we're going. Not only that, but on the other hand, though, I think Trump has shown us that there's still an extraordinary amount of racism in this country, various degrees. He's mobilized and empowered, I think, the most dastardly, despicable miscreants. But he's also awakened us to the fact that there's a lot more quiet racism than we are aware of. And let's face it, he started mobilizing it with birtherism. He's mobilizing more this weekend. People are saying, well, yeah, he's right about those people living in S-holes. And even though, for instance, Nigerians here have a higher percentage of college graduates even with advanced degrees than Americans at large, 43% versus 34%, for instance. So, I mean, we have all these dynamics going on. And I think we have to really put our hopes in these younger people, raising their consciousness. On the other hand, the left has to make sure it's clear that we believe in ethics and God and those kinds of things, too. We're not just libertines. Liberal doesn't mean libertinism. It means Vietnamese folk having individual rights and not being controlled by larger forces.
Right, but if you look at history, Aubrey, it's the liberals who've done the heavy lifting, whether it was ending mm-hmm. slavery, bringing mm-hmm. about civil rights, women's rights, mm-hmm. rights for children, human rights, etc. All of the conservatives have ever said is just, they've said, just say no, just say no. In fact, mm-hmm. it was the progressives also that first warned about Adolf Hitler, while the conservatives in this country wanted to accommodate him. So mm-hmm. the record, mm-hmm. to my mind, is absolutely clear. And in this idea of the liberals, I think you could add, put it in the context of what you could call the religious left. Mm-hmm. The religious left, after all, did end slavery and all of the other examples mm-hmm. that I gave. So just mm-hmm. in closing, Martin Luther King, had he lived, I think would have been the leader of the religious left. Where do you see that in terms of this pendulum swinging back? Because, mm-hmm. you know, we've just mm-hmm. literally, you know, I can't believe that these so-called religious folks are standing by Donald Trump. They did it after the Access Hollywood tape showed his disgraceful mm-hmm. misogyny, and now they're doing the same mm-hmm. after mm-hmm. his racist outbursts. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, what's your reading, just in closing, on the revival of the religious mm-hmm. left?
Yeah, well, no, I think we're seeing a real revival. William Barber, whom I've had the occasion to do some events with, I think he's a very important harbinger. We still have Jim Wallace, who's a big freedom fighter from Washington. We're seeing a number of elements on the religious left standing tall, and it's a real important trend. I think, and I think the left is gotten, those on the left, even those who aren't in the religious left, are not as reticent to talk about religion now, because we see it's an important field of contestation. Not only that, the evangelicals, 81% of whom supported Trump, they have shown their colors and disgraced themselves so much that it's really opening the eyes of the rest of the religious community around the country, and to see that we really have a real problem here. And I think that's going to really make a big difference in the future.
Well, Aubrey Hendricks, I thank you very much for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure. God bless you and all the best.
Well, thank you, Aubrey. And again, I've been speaking with Aubrey Hendricks, who is a senior fellow for Faith and Opportunity at Opportunity Agenda, a visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University, and a professor of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the likelihood of a backlash to the Trump Sessions assault on civil rights and voting rights.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times, they are a-changing.
So now you see the light, hey, stand up for your rights. Come on,
get up, stand up, stand up for your rights.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now on this Martin Luther King Day is Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and of African and African-American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Duncan.
Thank you for having me.
And while there's a lot of discussion about President Trump's racist remarks in the White House and the fact that he's attorney general is a relic from the old South, trying to turn back the clock, particularly on civil rights and voting rights, it's worth noting, and you and I have spoken quite a bit over the last couple of years, that where you are in St. Louis, in the north, not the south, it's had more than its fair share of riots in nearby Ferguson and continuing protests against the police and the judiciary in St. Louis. So give us a perspective on that anomaly where we assume that the North is more liberal on these matters than the South.
Well, one of the things we need to consider is the notion of sundown towns. And sundown towns are those towns where black folks were, there were posters posted all throughout the towns where black folks and their families were told they better be out of town before sundown or they would be killed. And they could only take with them what they could carry. And so they left behind property, acreage, livestock, as well as institutions. We heard about what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But what people fail to realize is that most of the sundown towns, and there's between 12 to 15,000 of them, occurred maybe 80 to 90% in the Midwest, the North, the West Coast, as well as the East Coast, the Upper East Coast. And in fact, my family is a product of the sundown town. My grandmother was chased out of Southern California, and that's why we moved up to Northern California, because of the result of the threats of being in sundown towns. And part of the reasons why this most purulent, crazy and dramatic and violent form of white supremacy occurred in these areas because they didn't have the de facto segregation that occurred in the South, where what happened to Emmett Till and others was supported by law. And I should tell you that the sundown towns were not necessarily legal, but they were extra legal because they occurred with the support of law administration. And so it just tells you how pervasive white supremacy is. It's not located in just one particular area.
Well, you know, we are continually told that Trump has about 35% support in this country. That's his so-called base. And we know that he governs entirely to the base, and he continually throws bones to the base. And I'm sure the base thought that what he said about African countries and Haiti and El Salvador, they probably agree with that. So this is what I would like to get to the bottom of, and I frankly don't know whether anybody has the data and anybody's done the study, is how many people and what percentage of the population in the United States is in fact still racist. I suspect that it may well be more than 35%.
Well, when we use the term racist, that's a very nuanced term. And there's a few books that have come out recently, one by Timothy Linsmeyer called White Folks, and this came out just in 2016, and another one, Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, where they talk about their family members and their close friends at home and in the close community of their families will spew racialized and racist sentiments, but who have black fans and friends and who are sincere in their friendships with people of color across the board, but at the same time feel that they are being placed at a disadvantage because of notions of affirmative actions or reparations for people who've been done wrong. And they blame the people of color as opposed to the people who are really doing them wrong, which is the white supremacist elite. And so it's very pervasive. And the reason why I say a nuanced form, because we have some who showed up in Charlottesville who will come out and try to kill you, and very physically violent. And then there are others who just hold certain sentiments, and I wouldn't even call them hateful, but there's some contempt and even jealousy, and where someone like me is I'm a suspect because of being able to speak with you, largely because I'm a black guy who had advantages placed before him.
So, but in to my point, though, Garrett, you know, about the base as opposed to, in other words, you keep asking yourself, why does Trump pander to the 30 to 35% as his polls, as his numbers keep going down, and ignore the majority? And then conversely, what is wrong with the majority in this country? Why are they tolerating the tyranny of the minority, where you have the most regressive government in memory and perhaps in the history of the United States, absolutely destroying institutions, turning back the clock, not just in race relations and in voting rights, but destroying the environment, undoing all of America's diplomatic and foreign policy arrangements around the world, and looting the country for their friends and cronies, and basically enriching the already super rich 0.1% of the 1%.
Well, two great questions. Let me address the second one first. I will begin by saying in the United States, one of our greatest cultural features is lying. And as Audrey and Rich once said, we lie with words, but we also lie with silence. And folks, to speak, there's this this ill feeling among the majority to address issues that they now hold themselves responsible for. We have to understand that to address these things, we have to admit that we made mistakes. And so that's part of it. And we do have people speaking out, but the everyday folks, there's a kind of a reluctance. I've had very few conversations with my white friends and colleagues about Trump. In fact, one, actually a colleague, when I was mentioning the campaigns, she put her hand up and walked away from me. And she is someone who deals with race in her work. Now, with respect to your first question about the lowering of the polls as he continues his madness, I have to go with some of the comedians. I believe it was 50 Cent who said that Trump never really wanted to be president, and he's doing his best not to serve another term. In fact, in addition to his malice, his malicious ways, he's just lazy. And I think he knows he's in over his head, and he didn't know what he was getting himself into. And I really, truly believe that he would rather step out of the White House. In fact, he's very seldom in the Oval Office and in the White House, and to move about his business. But at the same time, he can always put on his CV or his resume that he was the president of the United States.
Well, I think that's made pretty clear in the new book, Fire and Fury, by Michael Wolff, that he didn't really want it, and he was absolutely dumbstruck when he got elected, and his wife, Melania, was in tears. So I think that's pretty clear. But that doesn't mean the guy can't do a lot of damage and continue to do a lot of damage.
Oh, yes.
Because first of all, not enough of us vote, and that's just unbelievably criminally irresponsible, I think. But two, those of us that don't vote, and for many, you know, many express good reasons, and the frustration that we saw in the last election made it clear that's why Trump did so well, and it's why Bernie Sanders did so well, that the average American is just fed up with the political system, and they have every right to be. But
right.
The idea that that voting has consequences ought to be literally, you know, in everybody's consciousness now, because we see the results. We now know how incredibly detrimental it is when the American people elect the wrong person, and how difficult it is to get this person out of office.
Well, you know, on the one hand, I agree with you. I concur with you completely. But I will also add, it's not just opposition or shying away from the system or having a problem with the system. It's also having been disconcerted with the folks who are representing the systems. I recall while Hillary was doing her campaign, when she said that these black boys wearing baggies and hoodies need to heal. And I thought about, you know, while she was saying that, and even as I speak to you right now, I'm wearing baggy pants as well as a hoodie. I said she's drawing on the same racial narratives and stereotypes that she's dog whistling whereas Donald Trump is being much more explicit. And so I think in order for something to occur, and also it's not only the personality, but someone with a substantive plan, a substantive, especially economic plan, where they're bringing people together and being and distributing that wealth. But that is going to be in just very, very difficult, but not impossible. In fact, I always quote one of my favorite guys, Paulo Freire. He said, without a minimum of hope, we cannot so much as start the struggle. So even though we have to point out the issues that the both of us are spelling out, we also have to have hope. And I could point out one recent hopeful event that occurred within the Trump administration was when Ben Carson's attempt to reduce funding and support for economically disadvantaged families was struck down by the courts. And so and I saw that as being very hopeful, but at the same time, you have the Secretary of Education just raging havoc upon especially our public schools with the least the students, the most underserved students that we have across the nation. So I see it as a two-train running moment. But at the same time, we cannot be hopeless. And I'm not suggesting that you are, but there are a lot of folks out there. I know I get up every morning asking myself, what next, before I get on the computer or turn on the news.
Well, is it possible, though, that, as I say, I wonder about the 65% majority and why we can't end this tyranny of the minority sooner than it, you know, because every day that goes by, more damage is done. And the plutocrats in this country simply don't need to be further enriched. And it's an obscenity that this is a government of and by and for the plutocrats, even though this guy Trump ran as a populist and promised the very people
right.
who voted for him that he would make America great again, and then he turned on them and just took care of himself and his buddies on Wall Street, mostly in the private equity world. Remember, he was going to go against carried interest. Fund guys only pay 15% in taxes. Well, whatever happened to that? You know, it's all so obvious that this has been a massive con. So if you're conned, if you've sold a lemon and it keeps breaking down, do you spend more money trying to fix the lemon, or do you go back to the dealers and raise hell?
Well, let me put it like this. Both of us have been on the planet for a minute, and we've been through a number of things, periods like this, throughout our particular personal histories. And one of the reasons, you know, I emphasize the notion of hope and hopefulness is because the change occurs not with our generations. When we think about that 65%, there is another generation, if we go backward, the same generations, the younger, the more youthful generations, who have been the impetus behind change. And I'm around young people the majority of my social life, and I see hopefulness in them because on the one hand, they are fiercely afraid. I'll use that term, and I'll use that term lightly. They have fears, but at the same time, they're not going out without a fight. And their interests are a little bit different than those of our generation.
Well, it's often said that the millennials are post-racial and post-sexual, in as much as they don't care about people's sexuality and they don't have the racist hang-ups that previous generations have had. And, you know, obviously Trump is a throwback. You know, his father, Fred Trump, of course, was arrested in 1927
yes.
at a Ku Klux Klan rally in New York, and it does seem that that's in his DNA. But the millennials that you're referring to, I guess, are mm-hmm. you know the but the only thing is, and by the way, they have every reason to be mad as hell. I mean, it's not just Trump, but this for some reason or other, we're no longer investing in our kids as the future in terms of their education. Instead of turning them into centers of investment, we're turning them into centers of profit. And these kids
right.
are in debt before they even get a job. That I find extraordinary. I know Bernie Sanders brought it up, but that's just like ought to be, you know, if you take away their weed, which is this Sessions is doing, and you indenture them, I get a feeling that the younger generation may show up at the polls. They may be activated by the punishment that's being meted out against them.
Oh, absolutely. And we see this happening in a number of movements. And the one that in terms of social movements, that I really highlight is Black Lives Matter. And when there's a lot of criticism by particular groups against Black Lives Matter. But when you look at Black Lives Matter, they're very much like the Black Panther Party in the fact, insofar that they bring people together across culture, generation, and race, ethnicity, and religion. And so it's not just a black thing, but you have a group of people mobilizing around black folks. Because going back to Maya Angelou, she said, while I write about the black experience, I'm speaking to the human condition. And you have more and more folks seeing that. And so I see great possibility in movements like that and others that are not being highlighted.
Well, just in closing, though, the Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C., there's these inscriptions on these big slabs of I think it's sandstone, actually, or maybe it's marble, that are, one of them particularly struck me was that hate cannot conquer hate, only love can do that. So
yeah.
How does that apply? Because my sense is that and Hillary Clinton certainly fell into this trap when she talked about a basket full of deplorables. The people that are so upset with Trump, and I live in a kind of liberal bubble on the west side of Los Angeles, and where everybody watches MSNBC and reads the New York Times and the Washington Post, and they have no idea that this whole chunk of America that doesn't even know what's going on except for what Fox News tells them. And
right.
You don't want to demonize these people. You want to engage them, and you don't want to tell them they're idiots for voting for this guy that's conned them. So I think that maybe you can apply Martin Luther King's message to that. You know, we got to start loving our neighbors, even if we disagree with them.
Right. Well, let me place a great emphasis. In fact, you just spoke to my heart with respect to Martin Luther King's emphasis on love. And he's very clear about what he means about love. He's saying love is not a weak or sentimental thing. And he said love does not include the absence of power. And he said, but power without love is reckless and abusive. And he said love should guide our power, and power should clear out anything that gets in the way of love. And the other emphasis he places on love is not speaking at people, but speaking with people, and then translating that dialogue into a plan, some kind of project, and getting to work on it. And so it's not just sitting down having conversations, but it's putting your words into action. And he's very clear about that, and that's predicated on his notion of love.
Well, Garrett Duncan, I thank you very much for joining us on this Martin Luther King holiday.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Garrett Duncan, who's a professor of education and of African and African-American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.